From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Cuba, señores delegados.
Cuba, a free and sovereign state, with no chains binding it to anyone.
Che Guevara, 30 years ago today, he was executed by the Bolivian military with the help of the CIA. You'll hear his historic UN speech.
And speak proudly in this assembly, proving the justice of the phrase by which we will always be remembered. Free territory of America.
And we'll look at Che Guevara and the FBI, the U.S. political police dossier on the Latin American revolutionary. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Senate committee investigating allegations of campaign fundraising abuses turned its attention for the first time yesterday to the possibility that funds from the International Brotherhood of Teamsters were improperly directed into the Clinton-Gore reelection effort last year. The panel's chair, Senator Fred Thompson, Republican of Tennessee, suggested early yesterday that President Clinton knew about an alleged conspiracy to swap Teamsters' contributions in exchange for Democratic fundraisers directing big donors to contribute to the reelection effort of Teamsters President Ron Carey. Thompson's comments came as the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee questioned former White House Deputy Chief of Staff Harold Ickes on Democratic fundraising during the 96 campaign. But late in the day, Thompson backed away from the accusation, saying he'd left the wrong impression that Clinton attended a private meeting in 1996 with a consultant to the Teamsters just 4 days before the union decided to contribute $236,000 to state Democratic parties. Thompson said, if you have to eat crow, or maybe half a crow, it's better to eat it warm than cold. Senators who want to overhaul the campaign finance laws will try again today to breathe life into the bill opponents say is dead. The bill, sponsored by Senators John McCain and Russell Feingold, Republican and Democrat, would outlaw large unregulated donations to the political parties, known as soft money. Senate Republican leader Trent Lott says the bill is not going to pass this year, and he says he won't allow Democrats to force the issue. All 45 Senate Democrats want to overhaul current campaign finance laws. Dario Fo, an Italian playwright whose work combines biting political observation with side-splitting comedy, won the Nobel Prize for Literature today. Fo, who's 71 years old, is also an actor and is best known for the plays Mistero Buffo, Accidental Death of an Anarchist, and Can't Pay, Won't Pay. In 1980, Fo was refused an entry visa into the United States because of his membership in an organization supporting prisoners. A top South African defense official said yesterday that his name was illegally forged by the FBI in an elaborate scheme to trap suspected spies. Deputy Defense Minister Ronnie Kasrils, in an interview with the Associated Press, denied any involvement in the scheme and said he's annoyed over the unauthorized use of his name. He said U.S. officials made the admission to the South African ambassador in Washington and to Deputy President Thabo Mbeki. The FBI on Saturday arrested three people in Virginia who maintained ties to East German communists, while two of them held jobs in the U.S. government. Several members of President Clinton's Advisory Council on AIDS are threatening to quit because the White House refuses to spend federal money to buy clean needles for drug addicts. Leading the revolt is Chicago lawyer and Clinton fundraiser Robert Fogel. He says quite a few of the 30-member council would consider resigning. Fogel charges somebody in the administration is, quote, thinking more about politics than health. He says he plans to seek a vote on the resignations at the council's next meeting in December. The image of Chicago police as baton-swinging thugs is resurfacing long after city officials thought they'd banished it. One suspect says his leg was broken with a baseball bat in a lockup. Another man says police broke his jaw with a flashlight. A black officer says 11 white cops beat him and peppered him with racial slurs, even though he showed them his badge. The Justice Department is investigating one brutality case, and even department spokesperson Paul Jenkins, who once spoke glowingly of a new breed of wine-sipping, art-loving officer, was dumped after a public relations gaffe. Mayor Richard Daley has already set up a citizens' commission to find ways of cracking down on corruption. On Monday, Daley piled some more work on the commission's plate, saying that as soon as it finishes the corruption with the corruption probe, it should get busy finding an answer to the burgeoning brutality problem. President Clinton campaigned yesterday for a little-known Democrat whose challenge to New Jersey Governor Christine Todd Whitman could be a bellwether for the 1998 and 2000 elections. The president's day-long political trip, also taking him to Philadelphia, included five fundraisers, an unapologetic response to mounting criticism about White House money-raising tactics. As the president collected about $2 million for New Jersey and Pennsylvania Democrats, the point man for his reelection campaign, Harold Dickies, testified before the Senate committee investigating the White House and Democratic Party. And Saudi Arabia has denied allegations by an American human rights group that foreign workers are mistreated, saying the report was unfounded and antagonistic to Islamic tradition. The Saudi foreign ministry official who told the Associated Press by telephone yesterday from his office in the Saudi capital said the report is a new attack on Saudi Arabia and Islam. It is clear that some people make no secret of their hatred of Islam and Muslims. That's some of the news at this hour. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Today marks the 30th anniversary of the death of one of the most influential figures in the 20th century, Latin American revolutionary Ernesto Che Guevara. 30 years after his life ended in summary execution in a Bolivian country schoolhouse, few Americans, few Latin Americans, can forget him. Cuban leader Fidel Castro kicked off a congress of his ruling Communist Party yesterday with an emotional tribute to the legendary guerrilla, his former comrade in arms and close friend who was executed 30 years ago. Meanwhile, in Bolivia, hundreds of sympathizers trekked through the jungle paths yesterday to retrace the guerrilla leader's final steps before his capture by soldiers 3 decades ago. The march continued on to this village called La Higuera, where Guevara was taken and killed the following day by CIA-trained Bolivian troops. A week-long series of events have been commemorating the Cuban-Argentine guerrilla, which has drawn musicians, artists, labor leaders, and politicians. Born in Argentina in 1928 and killed in Bolivia on October 9, 1967, Che rose to international prominence as one of the key leaders of the 1959 Cuban Revolution that overthrew dictator Batista. After a period in the new Cuban government leadership, Che moved to spark revolutionary activity internationally, believing the only way to preserve social, economic, and political rights on a local level was through global action. He traveled to Congo and Africa and to Bolivia, where he was subsequently captured, interrogated, executed, and had his hands cut off so the fingerprints would prove that he was dead. Joining us right now to talk about what the U.S. knew about Che Guevara during the years that he was alive are two lawyers who got his FBI files. After we speak with them, we'll hear his well-known address at the United Nations in October of 1964. And then we'll hear a very revealing roundtable interview done with a group of reporters with him in December of 1964 in New York. Michael Ratner and Michael Stephen Smith join us now. They're authors of the book Che Guevara and the FBI, the U.S. Political Police Dossier on the Latin American Revolutionary. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy.
Hi, Amy.
Well, why don't we start with Michael Ratner. You're an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights and co-author of this book. How did you get these files?
A number of years ago, when I was doing a lot of work on the Freedom of Information Act, I applied to the FBI for their files on Che Guevara. And surprise of surprise, I got two huge boxes of documents back a couple of years ago, many of which were extremely interesting because a lot of them were just were recorded speeches of Che's that were live that no one else had. And a number of them were actual FBI and CIA documents that demonstrated that the CIA's spying and the FBI spying went back all the way till 1954, when Che was a 25-year-old in Guatemala. So we got them from the Freedom of Information Act. Many of them are blacked out, so we can't read everything that the FBI and CIA knew, and we didn't get many documents, so we don't have the precise documents on assassination plots against Che, but we have a great deal that's extremely interesting, extremely amusing in certain ways, and extremely serious in other ways, demonstrating how the CIA and the FBI went after Che.
Tell us about the first document that the U.S. saw, the CIA, in Guatemala. Let me put that question to Michael Stephen Smith, who co-wrote the book, Che Guevara and the FBI. He's author of also Notebook of a 60s Lawyer and is on the editorial board of Guild Notes, the Journal of the National Lawyers Guild. What about this first awareness the U.S. had of Che Guevara?
Well, in 1954 in Guatemala, there had been elected a man named Arbenz, who was running a really dramatic democratic reform government, and the city served as a magnet to attract radicals from all over Latin America, including Che. Che was there. He was a doctor. He was looking for work. He was there for 11 months, never found a job, but worked very hard, struggling to support Arbenz when the CIA hired an ex-furniture salesman, armed him in neighboring Nicaragua, and overthrew him. And that was a real political education for Che. And it was also the first time that Che came to the attention of the CIA and the FBI. And that's when they opened up what was to become one of the largest files they ever put together on anybody.
And they found a document on Che in what, the Guatemalan military files?
No, the Guatemalan police were watching him, and the CIA had agents down there. And we read about in Clement... And a guy named Phillips, an ex-CIA agent, wrote a memoir. And in it, he recalls the moment that he saw Che's name came up. And he turned to his boss and he says, "This guy's interesting. He's a doctor. He's 25 years old. He's down here working for Arbenz. You think we should open up a file on him?" And the other guy says, "Yeah, I think we should start one."
I think one of the important points about that is that Che was no different than probably 10,000 other people living in Guatemala at that moment who were opposed to the U.S. overthrow of Arbenz. And they kept a file on him. So what it really indicates is that the U.S. CIA and the FBI basically keep files on anybody who opposes their policy throughout Central or Latin America. Thousands of files.
Yeah, and the question is, you know, the FBI is supposed to be a domestic organization that fights things like international car theft and, you know, taking women across state lines for immoral purposes and bank robberies. What are they doing keeping track of a 25-year-old Argentinian physician in Guatemala? You know, this is supposed to be a domestic organization.
What are they doing?
Well, the answer to that is when the FBI got off the ground under Hoover's direction, Hoover was the guy who originally put the files together back in 1920. By 1921, they had 400,000 files on Americans. And the head of this whole operation was a guy named Palmer, Hoover's boss. And Palmer was really happy with Hoover's work. And he said to him, you know, he said, "You did great work, Edgar." He said, "Because we want these people to know that we're watching them." So if they had 400,000 files back in 1920, you can imagine how many they got now.
It's interesting that the files that you got, that you applied for through the Freedom of Information Act to the FBI, were mainly CIA files.
Right. What it indicates is the amount of sharing of information among U.S. agencies. If you actually look at some of these documents, there's probably 20 different agencies that are following Che in some way or another. Every branch of the Army, Navy, military, every branch of the White House, these files are distributed to everybody. They're all watching Che. So it's an extensive, extensive file about Che Guevara.
In our book, Che Guevara and the FBI, we reprint four different biographies that the secret police put together on Che. And the amazing thing is that they're so accurate. These people really know what they're talking about. They may be cynical, but they're sophisticated. One of them is 5 pages long. And it's so detailed about Che and Che's family that you gotta wonder, they must have terrific relations with all the other police forces in Latin America. As they knew, you know, Che had covered all of Latin America. By the time he was 25, he had been to almost every country, I think, except Jamaica. And they knew it. They knew all about it. That's the kind of outfit that we're dealing with. It's really international.
They're accurate, but on the other hand, there's something very interesting about the documents. Is they demonstrate the prejudices the United States has toward Latin Americans and toward Che, and the fact that they can't see past those prejudices a lot. So in one of the documents that is quite extraordinary, they basically realize that Che is quite a bright guy. And what does the document say? Che is fairly intellectual for a Latino. In other words, all Latinos are dumb, but Che happens to be a smart one. And that's the same attitude, really, that allowed them to intervene in Guatemala and allowed them to intervene in Grenada. And everywhere else, that's the attitude that they have toward Latin Americans in these documents.
See, the story behind that is the CIA sent an agent into Che's camp when he was fighting the Sierra Maestras in 1957.
This is when he would come to Cuba with Fidel Castro.
He went to Cuba with Fidel. And, you know, when they landed, there was 80 of them. They were on a motor yacht called the Granma. Batista knew they were coming. And when they landed, the Cuban dictator had organized troops to attack them. Only 12 were left. It was miraculous. The 12 got into the hills, and from there they made history. But when they were up there in the Sierras, the CIA sent in an agent posing as a journalist to find out about what's Che like. Is he a communist? Etc. And this guy actually slept in Che's tent with Che for a week. And he writes a report back that we got and we published in our book. And it's really interesting. They talk about he smoked long cigars that night, what he wore, his teeth, when he bathed. And then the agent winds up reporting that at night Che would read to his troops. And every night he would read to his troops. And this week he happened to be reading Baudelaire. And that's when this guy comments he seems pretty intellectual for a Latino.
We're talking to Michael Stephen Smith and Michael Ratner. They're two attorneys who got access under the Freedom of Information Act to the files of Che Guevara. And they put this book together, Che Guevara and the FBI, the U.S. Political Police Dossier on the Latin American Revolutionary. Let's talk a little more about what is in these files, because you just pointed out, Michael, that it was a journalist that was actually sent by the U.S. intelligence agencies to sleep in a tent. Is that right?
Yeah, that's unethical, Amy, isn't it, for a journalist to do that? Isn't that unethical?
They're still authorized to do that. I remember a few years ago when there was a big debate over whether the CIA and FBI, it was the FBI guidelines on internal security as well as overseas, whether they could use journalists. And apparently they still can.
But another point that you make, Michael, is his use of an inhalant because he was severely asthmatic and what the U.S. wanted to do about that.
Right. The U.S. was aware when he was in the Sierra Maestra, which is 1957 and 58, fighting for the liberation of Cuba, that he was an asthmatic and that he had very, very serious asthma. And the U.S. documents point out that his survival is absolutely – his survival is – dependent completely on this inhaler. And without this inhaler, basically, that he would die. And so what are they thinking about? They're obviously thinking about an assassination attempt. As some of your listeners may recall, they did try and poison Fidel Castro's cigars. I wouldn't be surprised if there's a document in here that we don't have yet that says, let's poison in his inhaler and let's try and kill him that way. That's what these documents lead to, that they were trying to assassinate Che probably as early as the 1957 and 58, of course, ending with the CIA assassination.
There's no smoking gun, but there's a pistol with a warm handle, and that's the request in 1964 that the FBI made for a set of Che's fingerprints. And we know then in 67, after they had succeeded in murdering him, that one of the Bolivian ministers, I believe it was the foreign minister, flew from Bolivia to Washington with a set of fingerprints so they can compare the two to make sure they got the right guy.
Let's talk about your trip recently. You actually had a book release party in Cuba. You met with Che's daughter. Tell us what this was about and what the reaction of the Cubans was to these FBI files. Didn't you also meet with the head of Cuban intelligence for many years?
Yes, we had an extraordinary week in Cuba. We met with Che's daughter, was at the conference we were at. She spoke, and then we sat around in an afternoon discussing reminiscence of Che. And people asked her what was her most important memory of her father and what was the thing she thought most about with her father. And she said that was that her father stood for love, that he stood for the fact of love of his children, love of humanity, and love of making sure that people did not feel pain anywhere in the world. Thomas Borges, the former comandante in Nicaragua, was in the audience. And he said, well, the other thing that he stood for was hate of imperialism. And that was the thing he hated the most. But in many ways, hate is the highest form of love, because hating imperialism is the highest form of love you can have. So it was an extraordinary day, week, actually, in Cuba. The other person we met who you mentioned was the head of the Cuban operations during this period when Che was undertaking revolutionary activities, as were the Cubans, and that's Manuel Pinheiro, who had never before made a public statement. He did make a public statement to us about Che's activities, Che's death. He put to rest forever, I think, if you needed to put it to rest, the fact that some people, like an author named Jorge Castaneda, are claiming that Fidel purposely failed to rescue Che in Bolivia. It's just a made-up story. What he said was, look, if they were going to, Che never had a plan to be rescued. It was either revolution or death, and that to rescue him, Cuba would have had to declare war on Bolivia, send in 10,000 paratroopers, and even then it probably would have failed. So it was not an issue, and people like that are saying that Fidel somehow purposely wanted to martyr Che, it's just complete garbage, and that's what I agree with that.
He also said, what went wrong? Because there's been a lot of criticism of Che, particularly on the left. It was a fool's errand. He should have never done it, you know, and so
gone
on.
Gone to Bolivia.
Gone to Bolivia. And Pinheiro said, you know, you have to take a chance. The problem was that Che's base camp was upended immediately after he set it up. So Che and his troops were caught off balance immediately. The second thing that happened to him was that they got split up from half their troop. So Che spent the 11 months remaining to him looking for the other half of the troop because he didn't want to abandon them. And then they got stuck fighting in a terrain that they didn't want to be on amongst Indians who spoke Quechuan, so they had a communication problem, and the population was too thin to support the guerrilla activity. So they took a chance. It didn't work. I think the thing you have to say is that's the kind of chance that revolutionaries take.
We're going to come back with Michael Smith and Michael Ratner in just a minute. Then we're going to hear a speech that Che Guevara gave at the UN in 1964, and then a far-ranging, rather personally revealing interview done with a bunch of reporters in New York in December of 1964. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, still joined by Michael Ratner and Michael Stephen Smith. They are co-authors of Che Guevara and the FBI, the U.S. Political Police Dossier on the Latin American Revolutionary, published by Ocean Press. You're talking about your trip to Cuba, and just to retrace Che Guevara's itinerary. He, after the Cuban Revolution, he was a government official in Cuba, and you can tell us why he got tired of that and left. He went to the Congo and then went on to Bolivia.
Well, the fact is that he wanted to leave from the very beginning. One of the conditions that he told Fidel when he signed up to go on with Fidel from Mexico City to Cuba was that he wanted to go on. He was an Argentinian, after all, and that's really where his heart lay, in Argentina. And Fidel said, by all means, you know, we need your support. You'll come with us, and when you're ready to move on, you'll move on.
He also understood that the Cuban Revolution could not survive on its own. And then without widespread revolutionary movements in Latin America, the Cuban Revolution would become isolated. And he always understood that the Cuban Revolution was the first episode in what he hoped was a wider revolutionary war, which is why his diary on the Congo is called an episode in the war in the Congo.
And the other thing was he wanted to show solidarity with Vietnam. You remember his famous call, create two, three, many Vietnams? He thought that if they opened up a second front, it would take some pressure off the Vietnamese. It was an act of solidarity with the Vietnamese Revolution.
It's interesting because I just heard his economic advisor speak, and he said when Che came to give his UN speech, he kept asking him, he was an American, he was a U.S. citizen, he kept asking him, do you think that the war in Vietnam would spread the troops too thin if we were to do something else somewhere else?
Right. It wasn't just to take the pressure off Vietnam. It was his understanding that with the U.S. tied up in Vietnam, it might be a time for revolutionary activity in Latin America because the U.S. couldn't do everything.
Michael, also in the book, Che Guevara and the FBI, you have these documents, CIA documents, that talk about the political leanings, as you were saying. Was Che an ardent communist, raising questions about where he was coming from and talking about him being a Latin American, sort of like a child? It was more about that than his politics.
Right. In fact, there's a very interesting part of the documents that demonstrate the prejudice of the United States. The United States officials, the CIA, cannot believe that Che can have a serious problem with the United States in the sense that the U.S. is economically exploiting Latin Americans or in any other way harming them. They put it all on Che's emotional attitudes. And what they say is that Che's hostility to the United States has no real basis, but is an attitude which is fairly common among young Latin Americans. And then they say his emotional hostility is typical of a national inhabitant of a small and backward and weak country towards the big and rich and strong country. So what are you getting from that? Just that the U.S. is a fine country, it's just that we're bigger and richer than the Latin American countries, and therefore Che's emotionally upset about that. Not that there might be millions and millions of people impoverished in Latin America and governments over democratic governments overthrown by the United States that might give Che a objective basis for disliking the United States.
Then they figured out that not only was Che a communist, but he wasn't the communist of your garden variety Russian leadership type that was pretty content on leaving things with the status quo and not rock the boat. He was a communist that wanted to spread worldwide revolution and challenge American economic and political power across the globe. That's the worst kind of communist. And there's a lot of information in our book about documenting that and being alarmed about that. And in fact, there's one document where John F. Kennedy's advisor, Richard Goodwin, who went to work for Johnson after Kennedy got killed.
Doris Kearns Goodwin's husband.
Yeah. And Goodwin took a couple of aides up in 1968 to brief the New York Times on the difference between the Russian communists and the Fidelista Cuban communists who wanted to spread the revolution worldwide. Those are the really bad ones. And he wanted to make sure the Times understood the line and got it right. We reprint that document.
How did Che fit into the Cuban Missile Crisis?
Oh, he did fit into the Cuban Missile Crisis in a very, very particular way. There were two ways in the book, at least one major way. After the missile crisis is over, there's going to be this so-called rapprochement with the United States and with the Soviet Union, and things are supposedly be okay, and the U.S. is then going to try and get back in this rapprochement with the Soviet Union. Che gives a speech in London basically saying the need for worldwide revolution is still crucial and important. He gives it to the London Daily Worker. That speech then comes back to the United Nations and Adlai Stevenson, who is the U.S. person at the United Nations, and they say, look, at how can we now get along with Cuba and even the Soviet Union when Che is still saying, even after the Soviet Union pulled out its missiles, that we need worldwide revolution. So they use that as they use Che's speech in London at that point, as our documents show, as an excuse for continuing a hot war against Cuba, really, and against the Soviet Union, a Cold War. Hmm.
And we're just now going to go to a speech of Che Guevara at the UN in October of 1964. He's very angry at the United States, but he also, when he left for the Congo, was very angry also at the Soviet Union. I mean, would you say that's the case?
I think that's an exaggeration, actually. I think that his speech in Algiers, which is what everybody cites when he says the socialist country shouldn't exploit the rich socialist countries should sell on better terms to the poor socialist countries. I think that's a more complicated speech. It says two things. It first thanks the Soviet Union for actually having good trade terms with Cuba and says the Soviet Union, more than other countries, has been willing to do this. It then goes into the critique of the Soviet Union and other socialist countries who have unequal trade terms. So I think it's a mixed speech. There's some criticism, but there's also a recognition of the support the Soviet Union was giving to Cuba. I mean,
he never lost
countries.
Sight that the United States was the main enemy, not the Soviet Union.
Well, I think we're going to clearly hear that in the speech that he gives right now. I want to thank you both for being with us, Michael Ratner and Michael Stephen Smith, both attorneys who got their hands on the FBI files on Che Guevara, and they have published them in a book called Che Guevara and the FBI, the U.S. Political Police Dossier on the Latin American Revolutionary. It is published by Ocean Press. And now we turn to that speech that Che Guevara gave at the United Nations in October of 1964. The speech is translated by WBAI Pacifica Public Affairs Director Mario Murillo.
La representación de Cuba ante esta asamblea se complace en cumplir en primer término el agradable deber de saludar la incorporación de tres nuevas naciones.
The Cuban delegation to this assembly has pleasure, first of all,
in fulfilling the pleasant duty of welcoming three new nations to the large number of nations whose representatives are discussing the problems of the world. We therefore greet, through their presidents and prime ministers, the people of Zambia, Malawi, and Malta, and we express the hope that from the outset these countries will be added to the group of non-aligned countries which struggle against imperialism, colonialism, and neo-colonialism.
De todos los problemas candentes que deben tratarse en esta asamblea, uno de los que para nosotros tiene particular significación.
Of all the burning problems to be dealt with by this assembly, one which has special significance for us and whose solution we feel must be sought first so as to leave no doubt in the minds of anyone, is that of peaceful coexistence among states with different economic and social systems. Much progress has been made in the world in this field, but imperialism, particularly United States imperialism, has tried to make the world believe that peaceful coexistence is the exclusive right of the great powers on earth. We repeat what our president said in Cairo, and which later took shape in the declaration of the second conference of heads of state or government of non-aligned countries, that there cannot be peaceful coexistence only among the powerful if we are to ensure world peace.
También hay que esclarecer que no solamente en relaciones en las cuales están imputados estados soberanos.
We must also say that it is not only in relations between sovereign states that the concept of peaceful coexistence must be clearly defined. As Marxists, we have maintained that peaceful coexistence among nations does not encompass coexistence between the exploiters and the exploited, the oppressor and the oppressed.
Es además un principio proclamado en el seno de esta organización.
Furthermore, a principle proclaimed by this organization is that of the right to full independence of all forms of colonial oppression. That is why we express our solidarity with the colonial peoples of so-called Portuguese Guinea, Angola, and Mozambique, who have been massacred for the crime of demanding their freedom, and we are prepared to help them to the extent of our ability in accordance with the Cairo Declaration. The brutal policy of apartheid is being carried out before the eyes of the whole world. The peoples of Africa are being compelled to tolerate in that continent the concept, still official, of the superiority of one race over another, and in the name of that racial superiority, the murder of people with impunity. Can the United Nations do nothing to prevent this? I should like specifically to refer to the painful case of the Congo, unique in the history of the modern world, which shows how, with absolute impunity, with the most insolent cynicism, the rights of peoples can be flouted. The prodigious wealth of the Congo, which the imperialist nations wish to maintain under their control, is the direct reason for this. In his speech on his first visit to the United Nations, our comrade Fidel Castro said that the whole problem of coexistence among peoples was reduced to the undue appropriation of another's wealth. He said, when this philosophy of despoilment disappears, the philosophy of war will have disappeared as well. The philosophy of despoilment not only has not ceased, but rather it is stronger than ever. And that is why those who use the name of the United Nations to commit the murder of Lumumba today, in the name of the defense of the white race, are assassinating thousands of Congolese. How can one forget how the hope that Patrice Lumumba placed in the United Nations was betrayed? How can one forget the machinations and maneuvers which followed in the wake of the occupation of that country by United Nations troops, under whose auspices the assassins of this great African patriot acted with impunity? But the scales have fallen from our eyes, and they now open upon new horizons. And we can see what yesterday, in our conditions of colonial servitude, we could not observe. That Western civilization disguises under its showy front a scene of hyenas and of jackals. That is the only name that can be applied to those who have gone to fulfill humanitarian tasks in the Congo. Bloodthirsty butchers who feed on helpless people. That is what imperialism does to men. That is what marks the white imperialist. The free men of the world must be prepared to avenge the crime committed in the Congo. We want to build socialism. We have declared ourselves partisans of those who strive for peace. We have declared ourselves as falling within the group of non-aligned countries, although we are Marxist-Leninists, because the non-aligned countries, like ourselves, fight imperialism. We want peace. We want to build a better life for our people. And that is why we avoid answering, so far as possible, the planned provocations of the Yankee. But we know the mentality of United States rulers. They want to make us pay a very high price for that peace. We reply that that price cannot go beyond the bounds of human dignity. Specifically, United States forces took part in the repression of the peoples of Venezuela, Colombia, and Guatemala, who carry on an armed struggle for their freedom. In Venezuela, not only do the Americans advise the army and the police, but they also direct acts of genocide from the air against the peasant population in vast rebel-held areas, and the United States companies established there exert pressures of every kind to increase direct interference. The imperialists are preparing to repress the peoples of America and are setting up an international network of crime. The United States interfered in America while invoking the defense of free institutions. The time will come when this assembly will acquire greater maturity and demand guarantees from the United States government for the lives of the black and Latin American population who reside in that country, most of whom are native-born or naturalized United States citizens. How can they presume to be the guardians of liberty when they kill their own children and discriminate daily against people because of the color of their skin, when they not only free the murderers of black people, but even protect them while punishing the black population because they demand their legitimate rights as free men? But it must be clearly established that the government of the United States is not the champion of freedom, but rather the perpetrator of exploitation and oppression of the peoples of the world and of a large part of its own population. To the equivocating language with which some delegates have painted the case of Cuba and the Organization of American States, we reply with blunt words that the governments pay for their treason.
Cobrarán a los gobiernos entreguistas su traición. Cuba, señores delegados,
Cuba, a free and sovereign state, with no chains binding it to anyone, with no foreign investments on its territory, with no proconsuls orienting its policy, can speak proudly in this assembly, proving the justice of the phrase by which we will always be remembered. Free territory of America.
Ernesto Che Guevara, addressing the United Nations in October of 1964. Today, on this 30th anniversary of his death at the hands of the Bolivian military on October 9th, 1967. The speech was translated by Pacifica Station WBAI's Public Affairs Director, Mario Murillo. We'll be back to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! In 60 seconds.
Boina tornasol, un día me contó que ya no estabas y se le quebró la voz. Aprendí tu diario y tus mañas de orador, como la Biblia moderna y con Che comandante y la suite de las Américas.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. And on this 30th anniversary of the execution of Che Guevara at the hands of the Bolivian military on October 9th, 1967, with the help of the U.S. CIA, we're going to bring you a very rare tape of an interview done with Che Guevara at the Cuban mission to the United Nations on December 16th, 1964, just a couple months after that UN address. It was a group interview, and among those who participated was WBAI News Director Chris Koch. Chris Koch is one of those outstanding reporters that makes Pacifica proud as we move into our 50th anniversary. He was the first journalist to travel to North Vietnam, to Hanoi, to cover the Vietnam War. He interviewed Malcolm X extensively and did a documentary on him. This is his introduction and the group interview with Che Guevara in 1964.
This is Chris Koch. On Wednesday night, December 16th, a group of American socialist journalists and writers spent about an hour talking with Comandante Che Guevara at the Cuban mission here in New York. I was there with a microphone and tape recorder, and this program will be a report of that meeting with the Cuban Minister of Industry. East 67th Street between Madison and Fifth Avenue was blocked off by barricades and a handful of policemen. The group of writers who had met at a restaurant in the neighborhood were stopped by police at the corner. We waited until clearance came from the Cuban Mission building near the center of the block, then walked into a large townhouse through a tight line of New York's finest, making comments and nudging us as we tried to get through the door. We waited in a storeroom for about a half an hour and then went upstairs, into a large room with a high ceiling, a desk, a marble fireplace, chandeliers, and three sofas, partially surrounding a large coffee table. The writers ranged themselves on the sofa, and Comandante Guevara knelt on the floor in front of the table. Those standing soon settled down on the floor around the table next to him. Comandante Guevara was dressed in pressed military fatigues and polished black boots. During the conversation, he was in constant motion, lying on his side, shifting to a squatting position, back to his side, resting his head on his hands, and puffing constantly on a cigar. Constant motion. Guevara was relaxed, joked much, smiled always. The conversation was hardly orderly, and much of it was of little real use. At least a portion of those present seemed more interested in advice on how to conduct the North American Revolution than on information or analysis of the Cuban. and for a good portion of the discussion, such questions were more revealing than the answers. Guevara, too, quickly sensing that the session would be less than demanding, began to take the questions in a spirit of general humor. Nonetheless, there were portions that may be interesting. I have reorganized the material somewhat and left out several lengthy digressions, and from time to time have rephrased a question. Guevara's answers, however, are unretouched and presented exactly as they were given. One area of the discussion dealt with his own revolutionary past and his analysis of the Cuban guerrilla struggle.
You are Argentinian by birth, and rather than make a revolution in the Argentine, you went out and, as I understand it, traveled and stayed in several countries before coming into conjunction with Fidel Castro in Mexico. I would like to ask how you look back upon this and see it as some kind of lucky juncture, or that somehow you were searching until a revolutionary situation coalesced, or?
Bueno, es una pregunta más bien de intimidad, así de círculo, después de tres o cuatro coñac y remembranza de otras cosas.
It seems to be a question to be answered after three or four drinks in a more intimate atmosphere.
En general, lo que se puede decir,
in general, what we can, could say,
que hay algunos momentos,
there are some moments
de nuestra revolución,
in our revolution,
que son cosas de loco,
that are things completely mad.
El ataque crazy, a Moncada,
the attack against the Moncada barracks,
la salida en el Granma,
the expedition of the Granma,
la continuación de la lucha con el grupo de hombres,
the struggle with the handful of men that remain,
la defensa contra la última embestida de la dictadura en la sierra,
the defense against the last great attack of by the dictatorship in the sierra maestra,
la invasión de las villas,
the invasion of the province of Las Villas,
la toma de las principales ciudades,
the seizure of the principal towns.
Cada una de esas cosas se analiza.
If you analyze one, each one of those things,
y se llega a la conclusión de que había loco de por medio,
you reach the conclusion that there was something mad in the middle, something crazy in the middle.
Y como todas ellas concatenadas llevaron a la toma del poder,
and as all of them as a chain led to the seizure of power,
tal vez se podría llegar a la conclusión de que para tomar el poder se necesita ser un poco loco.
You may have to reach the conclusion that in order to seize power you have to be a little crazy.
O por lo menos no tener miedo a lo que vaya a pasar.
Or at least not to be afraid to what may happen.
Que es lo que nosotros no tuvimos, sinceramente.
Which we didn't have, honestly.
At what point did you know that you had won?
¿En qué momento se dieron cuenta de que habían ganado?
Eso ya es una pregunta de una película de la USIS.
That is a question which belongs more to a film by the United States Information Agency.
Someone then asked if audacity and a certain craziness were necessary to make a revolution, how these qualities could be kept and nurtured after the revolution had been successful. How does a government prevent the growth of bureaucracy?
Esa es la pregunta que nosotros nos hacemos.
That is the question that they formulate themselves.
Y buscamos una serie de respuestas.
They seek a series of answers.
De experimentos.
Of experimentation.
Pero no podemos contestar.
But they cannot answer.
Totalmente.
Totally.
Dentro de unos años, sí.
In a few years, yes.
About keeping audacity alive, have there been any changes in Cuban education in terms of preventing youngsters from growing up into small B bureaucrats and into dead souls?
Evitar que los jóvenes se conviertan en pequeños burócratas.
Estuvimos discutiendo el otro día, tú.
We were discussing that the other day.
¿Estás repitiendo la pregunta?
You were repeating the question.
Sí.
Yes, there have been.
Todavía no está estructurado como un sistema.
We have not made a structure out of it as a system.
Pero hay la identidad entre el estudio y el trabajo.
But there is the identification between the studies and the work, labor.
El trabajo de los estudiantes ayudando a determinadas tareas agrícolas.
The students work, they cooperate in certain agricultural works.
El significado de este trabajo.
The meaning of the of this work.
Por ejemplo, para ir a recoger café.
For example, to collect coffee. To
solamente tienen
coffee.
Derecho a ir los que han aprobado todas las asignaturas.
Only those students which have passed all subjects can go.
El trabajo es un premio.
Work is a price.
Los tipos de escuelas.
The kinds of schools.
En lugares difíciles.
In difficult places.
Por ejemplo, la escuela de maestros voluntarios.
For example, the school of voluntary teachers.
En la Sierra Maestra.
In the Sierra Maestra.
Y otras experiencias de ese tipo.
And other experiences of that sort.
Almost all American psychoanalysts say that the social revolutionary as a type is immature and is fighting out infantile problems. Now, you are trained as a psychoanalyst and you are a social revolutionary. Would you care to comment on this view of American?
Yo creo que no hay que buscar.
I don't think we have to look
tan digamos. Tan, no hay que ser tan rebuscado en la apreciación de los hechos.
We need not be so detailed in the appreciation of facts.
Los revolucionarios no son gente normal.
Revolutionary people are not normal people.
Eso se lo puedo asegurar.
That I can assure you.
Pero, en definitiva,
but
lo importante es que la capacidad de construcción y de sacrificio.
But in the long run, the important thing is that the capacity for sacrifice
construcción
and construction
se va desarrollando.
Be developed.
El revolucionario hace la revolución.
The revolutionary makes the revolution.
Pero la revolución hace el revolucionario.
But the revolution makes the revolutionary.
Y es una interrelación constante.
And there is an interrelationship, a constant interrelationship.
Donde el revolucionario va alcanzando grados más altos.
Where the revolutionary achieves a higher level
de conciencia.
Of conscience.
¿Por qué empezó? Se lo podemos dejar a los psicoanalistas si
quieren. Why did he start? We can leave that to the psychoanalysts.
Pero el hecho final.
But the final fact
es un resultado de la lucha
is a result of the struggle
y de la acción de las masas sobre el propio revolucionario
and of the actions of the masses on the revolutionary himself.
In many ways, the Cuban revolutionary movement has been unique. At this point, do you think there are any lessons from that uniqueness that can be adapted to other revolutionary movements, either in other Latin American countries or here?
No, yo no empleé la palabra caso único.
Oh, I did not employ use the word unique.
Peleo contra la palabra caso único.
I fight against the word unique.
Dije caso de loco.
I said thing, a crazy thing.
Pero loco hay mucho.
But there are a lot of crazy people.
Y las bases sociales que llevan a Cuba a la revolución.
The social basis which carry Cuba onto a revolution.
Y el lugar donde se desarrolla.
And the place where they develop.
Desde el punto de vista de la geografía o de la estructura social.
From the point of view of geography or social structures.
Es muy parecido a los demás países de Latinoamérica.
It's very similar to those of other Latin American countries. Are very similar to those of other.
Más todavía.
And even more. Furthermore.
En Venezuela.
In Venezuela.
Se han cometido los mismos errores que nosotros cometimos.
The same mistakes we made have been made.
Y han seguido la misma línea que nosotros seguimos.
And they have followed the same road we follow.
No aprendieron nada, en realidad.
They did not
learn todos nuestros defectos.
Anything from our mistakes.
Pero van por el buen camino.
But they go in the right direction.
What mistakes specifically do you make?
Específicamente, ¿qué errores?
El excesivo acento en la lucha en la, por la lucha en las ciudades, por ejemplo.
Too much stress on fighting in towns, within the cities.
Se pierde mucho cuadro.
You lose too many cadres.
Y no se saca dividendo suficiente.
And there is not enough profit.
Espectacular nada más.
It's very spectacular, but that's all.
La alianza con una serie de militares en el intento de golpes.
The alliance with a number of military people in an attempt of coup d'etat.
Como Carúpano y Puerto Cabello.
Like Carúpano and Puerto Cabello.
The discussion also ranged for some time on developments throughout Latin America and an analysis of the various Latin American countries. Guevara was asked at one point whether the United States' allegation that the weapons used in Venezuela by the guerrillas were of Czech manufacture, exported from Cuba. Guevara replied that Cuba did have a lot to do with the problem of Venezuelan weapons, because Cuba had said for a long time that the only way to liberate a country, when you do not have weapons, you have to rise with the weapons you have, and then have to take the rest of the weapons from the enemy. To that extent, he said, they were responsible. He emphasized, time and again, however, when speaking of other Latin American countries, that conditions were different everywhere, had to be analyzed, and that there was no formula for revolutionary struggle. For example, he asked,
would you offer us an analysis of the Brazilian debacle?
It's too much to ask to make an analysis.
Ese es un país que es unos 80 veces más grande que Cuba.
That's a country which is about 80 times the size of Cuba.
Y tiene 10 veces más población.
And 10 times its population.
Nosotros ponernos a hacer un análisis así.
For us to make an analysis like
poquito,
that.
Sería un poquito pretencioso.
Be a little presumptuous.
Lo fundamental.
The fundamental thing.
Es que el gobierno y las organizaciones de izquierda y las masas populares.
Is that the government and the leftist organizations and the popular masses.
Confiaron en lo que se llaman las instituciones.
Trusted the so-called institutions.
Y en las instituciones no se pueden confiar.
And institutions cannot be trusted.
A menos que sean de la misma clase.
Unless they belong to the same class.
Y el ejército naturalmente no era de la clase proletaria.
And naturally the army did not belong to the proletariat.
Eso es la síntesis, no el análisis.
I would say that is a synthesis, not an analysis. What does the major think about the case of Puerto Rico? Can it be settled within the UN, or eventually Puerto Rico must have to appeal to the same means as Venezuela, for example?
Bueno, Puerto Rico es un caso distinto al de Venezuela.
Puerto Rico is a different case from that of Venezuela.
Desde el punto de vista de las posibilidades de lucha, de la misma lucha, ¿no?
From the point of view of the struggle itself, or the possibilities for struggle.
Naturalmente es un pueblo colonizado.
And naturally it is a colonial people.
Pero la circunstancia de estar dentro del sistema norteamericano.
What the circumstances of it being within the American system.
Cantidad de puertorriqueños que viven en los Estados Unidos.
The number of Puerto Ricans which live in the U.S.
La presión que hacen sobre toda la cultura del pueblo puertorriqueño.
The pressure made on the whole culture of the Puerto Rican people.
Y, en fin, sobre su su idea de pueblo en sí.
And in short, the pressure on its idea as a people.
You've been listening to an interview done in 1964, December 16th, a roundtable interview done by a group of reporters, including WBAI Pacifica news director Chris Koch, 1964, just a few years before Che Guevara was executed on this date, October 9th, 30 years ago, in 1967, by the Bolivian military with the help of the U.S. CIA. And that finishes up our special on Che Guevara today. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Errol Maitland is our New York engineer. Andy York engineered from Washington. Julie Drizin, our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!